This is Brock and Salk.
Brock Huard is my hero.
What Brock Huard says?
No, he's not a friend.
Subscribe to receive every episode at Apple Podcasts or on Google Podcasts.
Ah, we stink, man.
Now, here are your hosts, Brock Huard and Mike Salk.
No one!
Brock Huard is my hero as well. That's why I get up as early as I did to come in here and do this thing with you. Where's Mike Salk? He's the one that gets up early. How am I sitting here with you, Brock?
Dream come true. I've waited for this day. We've done little 10-minute hits for the Apple Cup, right? Where we tape some shows ahead of time, and we've had the pleasure. I've certainly done a number of segments with you, Bob, and I think we've done, how many shows have we done together? You filled in.
Yeah, we've done a number of them over the years.
It's our first podcast. I mean, this is a big deal.
And you've told me I can curse. And I can talk about whatever I want. This is going to be a crazy
hour.
You
can let your guard down. You had a great story about a booger slug that Chris Egan had.
I don't know if I've ever said that publicly, but I guess it's sort of public now.
Well, that's what podcasts are for.
We'll get into that.
Let your guard down. Let your guard down.
Well, I'm letting Chris Egan's guard down. Oh, well, it's an honor for me to be here. No, it's very few things I get up early for. I'll say that. I am not an early riser. Kyle knows this. You know this, Brock.
It is a time check. For those listening on tape delay, we are taping this. It is 11:20 a.m.
Okay. This is usually when I'm getting out of bed, rolling into the bathroom to brush the teeth, the whole thing. So I had to, in order to get here from West Seattle, I had to leave last night.
That's true. Well,
so,
you're a baseball guy. That's your years in the majors.
That's
Bob.
Exactly right. You stay up late. The game gets done. You don't get home to the wife and kids till probably around midnight. And then, you sleep in the next day. That's how it goes.
Adrenaline runs and everything else.
Well, what about baseball, though, Brock? We're five games into a Mariners season. And as you might be stunned to hear, there's some panic on social media surrounding this team. And I sort of get caught between how seriously do I take what we've seen and how much do I dismiss it as, hey, it's early, it's, they're just getting their feet under them, they'll get through opening day, we'll figure out who this team is about 30 games into a season. That's generally my belief, but it gets hard when when you're living in the moment and watching a team struggle the way they have out of the gate.
Especially offensively, right? I mean, if it's 10-8, 9-7, you play in some of the band boxes you can play in baseball, you kind of live with it, you kind of ride it off and say, okay, good, I'm at least thankful they're coming out and hitting early, and especially the young guys. But man, when your offense struggles, and I hate to, I do my best, Bob, especially on this podcast and over the years, to not footballize everything when it comes to baseball, right? To not just compare and contrast the two. But when you do not have an offense that's hitting, and right now the Mariners are 29th in average, just ahead of the Diamondbacks at .183. They're 26th in OPS at .590. They're tied for second to last in runs scored with 12. They are fourth in the league with 24 walks, so they're controlling the zone. They're just not.
CTZ, baby.
Yep, they're just not hitting it. And obviously, Jared, Julio, and Toro have combined for three hits in 40-something attempts. So they're not coming out hitting it. And when you don't have an offense in baseball, it's like not having an O-line in football.
Yeah.
It's just a hard watch. Right? How many times did Bob Stelton clamor? Can I just, you and Roger from Tacoma, can I just have a guard?
Yeah.
Can I just have a line? Can we just draft linemen? Can anybody protect? How many times, Bob, have you said that to me over the years?
Oh, I've said it to anybody who would listen, Brock. That's how it's gone. Please, somebody listen to me. Is anybody hearing me? Yeah, no, you're right. I think if we didn't have last season go the way that it did, I mean, 90 wins is amazing, going down to the final series of the season, the stadium's packed. It was awesome, but we kept talking about run differential all year, and they ended the year at minus 51. So you knew, okay, we got to improve the offense. So now you look at it, they start the season, and they're still lacking offensively, at least through five games. Again, not panicking, but it's that trend that continues from last season. You're going, okay, that the idea that they could do that again, that they could have that run differential and have the success they had last year, just isn't reality. It's just not.
No.
Everything fell the right way last year. So I get the sense of, boy, nothing looks different to me other than the fact that at this point they're losing as compared to last year. So I understand the the bit of panic out of the gate, but it is, I mean, come on, it's 162 games. Yep. You're five games in. So let's see, once we get past opening day, I think the pomp and circumstance of the season opening, you're opening on the road, you're in some goofy weather out there in places, and you're going to have the home opener here on Friday. Once you get to some normal part of the season where it's, okay, now we're in the rhythm of the season. Now we're now we're just playing games and there's nothing special about any of these games in particular. That's where we're going to see what they are.
Yes, and you know, these are two spots with a kind of a wacko spring, right? Everything condensed this spring as well in a late start. If you were to look at and go, okay, you, where would you want to go play? Where would you, if you have to open on the road, right? We do this in football all the time as well. We look at the Seahawks schedule or Huskies, Cougs, and go, okay, so where, what's September going to look like? How many home? How many road? Where are they going to go? I mean, they went to, I think, two with an abbreviated spring to – just not a great place to open in the snow in Minnesota, and then a good Chicago White Sox team, right? A playoff baseball team. Two good teams. They're two good teams that are solid, that have made moves. Minnesota's obviously added in Correa a difference maker. And so, yeah, there's many ways to explain this. And I'm sure on an everyday basis in the afternoons, you are doing just that. I think the hard part is you were just hoping, please. Please, Lord, just once, let one of these young stars come up and let one of them just not have to struggle out the gate. Can we just, can they just hit the ground running? Can they just come out and, wow, you know, maybe first at bat home run. Oh my gosh. Are you kidding me? This is amazing. After an amazing spring, can we just see Julio and then Jared over there? Just don't grit your teeth. Don't squeeze the bat too tight.
Yeah.
Right? You just would love, even if some of the other guys, Gino and Winker and Frazier, veteran guys, they got a lot more of a baseball card. They got a lot more of a resume. If they struggle, okay, but give me my young blood. Let me just see my youngster go out there, right? And just have the time of their lives and keep doing what certainly Julio did all spring long. But you know what hits you in the teeth? The reality of Major League Baseball. It is a different beast than single A, double A, triple A. It is a different beast in the spring. In fact, Bob, this is kind of cool. You and Kyle are there. There's no Howdy. Howdy's sick. Salk's out this week. Do this little exercise. I got a little exercise for you. You ready?
Okay.
Take your hand right now. It doesn't matter, right or left hand, but probably you're right. Take your right hand and put it out in front of you. Palm facing you.
We are both doing
palm facing.
Oh, facing. Okay.
Palm facing you.
I'm waiting for a punchline here.
Lines on our hand about where the season's going.
Nope, I don't need you to do any of that. But as you look at your hand right there, this was an analogy given to me in a podcast that I'm going to release soon. One of my Above and Beyond podcasts with a major league umpire.
Kyle and I are actually sitting here holding our hands.
Good.
I mean, people are walking by the window wondering good. What Mike Sievers is looking at.
Awesome.
What is happening?
Awesome. As you look at your hands, you see your pinky, your ring finger, your middle finger, your index finger, your pointing finger, they all basically have the same gap between them, don't they? Like as you're looking at it, maybe your pinky to your ring finger's got a little bigger gap, but it's about the same gap in all of them, right?
Yeah.
That is the equivalent of single A, high A, double A, triple A. That's about the jump that you make. Now look at the difference between your pointer finger and your thumb.
Ooh, that's a big one.
That is spring training. That is AAA. That is everything but the major leagues. And you see that gap? It's about the equivalent of all those other gaps added up. And that is, that was, as I said, a major league umpire. You can put your hand down now. A major league umpire gave me that analogy. Mike Malinsky, great guy, great podcast will be coming soon. And man, that just resonated with me because after watching these guys for the last 13 years and so many of them come up and so many of them flirt and so many of them find a little success, but then reality hits of, wow, that is one significant gap between all the other baseball that Julio has ever played and Jared has ever played in their lives compared to now getting into the big league arena where it is flat out different in the best of the best.
Well, and I've heard this from a ton of athletes just in the jump from the minor leagues, if you will, is bigger from AAA to major leagues than it is from college football to pro football, than it is from college basketball to pro basketball.
Yep.
Hockey, I'm not quite as sure about. But I've heard that repeatedly, like that gap in talent and that jump and that just, you know, kind of holy heck moment, like this is a different world. Yeah, those are all big jumps, and some guys don't make them, as we've seen. There's busts in all sports every year, but that is the biggest in terms of this. I'm just facing a completely different level of talent, the likes of which I haven't truly been exposed to on a regular basis.
Well, and when you watch our guys pitch, right, when you watch Munoz come in, you're like, how do you hit that?
Yeah.
How do you possibly, right? He had three up, three down the other night, all fastball sliders, like middle of the White Sox lineup. Like, yeah, I'm sorry, you just, sorry, there's human limits to what you can and cannot do, to what your eye can and cannot do, to what your bat speed can and cannot do. And when you've got 101 paired with 88 and they look exactly the same out of that guy's hand and the delivery, you're guessing. You're just, mm-hmm. you're up there flat out guessing.
Well, the other part, Brock, is that, A, you're right. I mean, we are longing for one of these prospects to turn into a superstar. We're longing for the next Ken Griffey Jr. or Alex Rodriguez or anybody that you, that's homegrown that turns into a superstar and lives up to that potential. But at the same time, you're longing for it because the club is relying on it. They kind of didn't spend the way we thought they would spend in the offseason because they looked at these young guys saying, well, we've got them. You know, we've got Julio ready to go. We've got Kelnick in year number two. He's got that, you know, worked all the kinks out of his swing, so to speak, got that 1 year under his belt. So we're not as desperate for a Chris Bryant or a Trevor Story or a Freeman or a Reynolds from Pittsburgh or any of these guys. We got Winker and we took on Suarez. We're fine because the young guys are going to make up the difference. And right now, again, five, I feel like I have to keep throwing that out there, five games, but right now, you're seeing anything but that. Hey, the young guys are going to make up for what you didn't acquire in free agency.
Okay, two things jump out. A, you brought up, you know, in talking to guys, the difference between baseball and the jump from AAA to the majors being harder than all the other ones. I had a thought through that. Secondly, as you just said, didn't those young guys force that decision? I think it was on last week's podcast because every time, so it starts next week in Seattle, right? With Pete Carroll will have his first team meeting at the OTAs and he will tell every young guy, and it will happen after the draft and training camp and everything else. He will tell them, listen, we don't make the decision. You make the decision for us. You are going to, don't count numbers. Don't look in your meeting rooms. Don't try to do, you will make the decision for us. Wouldn't you say, Bob, that Julio and Jared and Kirby, who I know is not on the big club right now, Brash last night, wouldn't you say, if you're in Jerry and Scott's shoes, those guys made that decision? That wasn't like, well, I don't know. I don't know if they're ready. Like, they've done everything through the minors and even this spring to make that decision. To your point, the decision where they didn't spend on vets, didn't those young guys make that decision for them?
They did to an extent. Julio certainly did. I mean, he was completely dominating to where it almost felt like, what are you gaining from this? This isn't the right level of competition. Jared didn't dominate the way Julio did. And he sort of worked his way in verbally, yep, as much as he did with his production. Yep. If you look at his numbers at AAA, I know he wasn't there. You know, he was hardly there, but he didn't rake the way Julio did. Mm-hmm. And it was more about him talking out in the press saying, I know for a fact I could have helped this team, in response to the whole Kevin Mather debacle. And it seemed like there was an urgency to get him in there to prove that, you know, Kevin Mather was a big dope and saying all the things that he said, and they were manipulating service time, what have you, with Kelnick, and he's ready. Was he ready? I don't know. I mean, would it be the worst thing in the world if he continues to struggle, they send him back down? I mean, I don't know where he's at in terms of is he mentally ready for this level of play, because he feels like he grinds at a different level as opposed to Julio, yeah, who seems to have a personality carefree, that's sort of, mm-hmm, built for struggle. Like, he's going to find his way through it. He's a little lighter. He's not grinding that bat into sawdust up there. So it feels like they're two different mentalities, and one is going to serve himself better, and that's Julio.
Man, 9 strikeouts and 15 at bats for, yeah, Jared. I know that's super, super small, but man, that's hard. 7 for 14 for Julio. I mean, those two guys have struck out 16 of their 29 at bats.
Yeah, here, can I give you a distinction between the,
yeah,
two,
yeah,
so far? Is Julio, yeah, I think, has been fooled, and a lot of those strikeouts are looking. He's looking like, all right, that wasn't a strike, ready.
He's getting more off-speed than anybody on the team, yeah, combined.
But then Kelnick, yep, just looks like he doesn't know what's coming. Like, he looks, mm, like he's confused up there, whereas Julio seems to be waiting on a pitch, and he's figuring out the strike zone, as opposed to, I didn't expect to see an off-speed pitch in this situation. Or Kelnick just looks like he doesn't know. Like, he's guessing. You always hear that. The guy goes up there with a plan, then there's, yeah, the guy that goes up there and he's guessing. That feels like Kelnick. Like, he's got no idea, and the off-speed stuff is killing him right down the pipe. I was watching it yesterday, 82 miles an hour, right down the middle of the plate, and he's buckled by it. So they just look different in their strikeouts.
Yeah. Back to the other point, which was a good one that you had heard over the years. I'm just thinking through this and kind of want to talk. You know, this is the beauty of a podcast, Bob. Okay, we have time. Time is our friend. And we are going to get to Chris Egan's booger in a second because it speaks to this week.
I want to apologize in advance to Chris Egan because I don't think I've said this anywhere.
He's a big boy. He can live with it. Okay. The same thing happened to Joe Davis last year, one of my partners, actually in Pullman. So we will compare notes and we will share that story here momentarily. But when I think about these young guys and when I think about that point and the difference, like I think back to my first mini camp with the Seahawks. Okay. I get drafted. We do our little combine and then we get on the field and I had always heard this game is so fast. NFL game, it's so fast. It's so different than the college game. You just wait. And I remember even in OTAs, mini camp, first time, blue right, F short, two jet flanker drive. And I drop back. It's a 7-step drop and I just like threw to Brian Blades. Right. And Holmgren's like, why'd you throw it there? I was like, good question. I don't know. Because I didn't know the reads. I didn't know the coverage.
I don't know.
I didn't know any of that.
It was open.
But I just, he was open. But he was open for a very small little window of time. And the windows are a lot smaller. But you know what? In football, it's man coverage. It's cover three. It's cover two. Here's our blitz packages. Like the football is deeper. And there's more to it and more volume. But it's not like a whole new game. Basketball, you got man-to-man, you play 2-3 zone, a little 1-3-1, we get traps, we get press, but you've kind of played that game in those schemes through junior high, high school, AAU, college, NBA, for all those games those guys have played. There's similar schematics. You get to baseball, and it is so individualized when Jared Kelnick gets in that batter's box, and he is seeing stuff that he has never, and Julio, have never seen before.
Mm-hmm.
Never seen before. I have never seen that combination of 102 with 88, and I don't know how to process this. I don't know how to attack this. That dynamic, not the game. The game's 90 feet, 6 inches, 66 inches, right? 60 feet, 6 inches. Like those things are the same. But what these pitchers in today's game are able to do at the major league level is unlike anything those guys have seen in their lives. And I don't know without experience how you train for that, how you prepare for that. How you, if you were Julio, were ever going to be ready for what he saw out the gate? Is that fair as I walk through that, or do you poke holes?
No. I think it's completely fair. I think what's changed is sort of the belief that, hey, you know, we've talked to Blowers about this. You know, it used to be you need 400, 500 at-bats at the minor league level. That's sort of your minimum before you come up to the big league. You need this amount of time. There was just kind of this marker, if you will. And that's obviously been sped up. That's changed depending on the talent level. And Julio hasn't had that. And Kelnick didn't have that. So, you know, are they rushed up? There was always the fear. You're going to expose these guys and you're going to break them. That's what happened to Mike Zunino. He got called up too early. He didn't have enough at-bats at the minor league levels. Dustin Ackley, same thing. You broke him. I think that's the part that's changed. And you're right that they're seeing the ball do things you didn't see at the AA or AAA level. And you're seeing their ability to locate, you know, just nick the corner of the plate in a way that they're up there surprised and they're looking at the ump like, really, that was a strike, huh? You know, you're seeing it with Julio, like, what? How? That's okay. And then I'm sure when he goes back and looks at it on film, you're gonna go, wow, okay, these guys are able to do something with the ball I have not been able to see. So I've got to have a different approach. I've got to be much more proactive. I've got to protect the plate in a different way with two strikes than I did at the AAA level, where I could sort of count on them to make a mistake or they're going to try to blow one by me at 95 down the middle and I'm just going to eat all day on that. So these guys are doing things, you're right, at this level that they haven't really been exposed to, especially on a consistent basis with their ability to locate and change speeds and just the flat-out movement on the ball.
It's April 13th, 2022, as we tape this podcast. We're 2 weeks and a day from the NFL draft. Last week on the podcast, I attacked corners and linebackers. Today, we're going to do some O-line, D-line guys that I love in college football, that I'd love to see the Seahawks make a move on. So we'll do that here in just a second. But, Bob, it's April 13th, 2022. Kyle, as well, you can weigh in on this.
Thank you.
At some point this summer, between April 13th and the end of the regular season, September 30th, is Bob Stelton going to utter on the afternoon show, "It's really too bad these guys were rushed to the bigs. It's really too bad that they rushed Julio and even Jared a year ago and did not give them the seasoning." I don't know why my voice cracked. The seasoning they needed in the minor league level. Is Bob Stelton going to utter that opinion over the next 5 months?
I'm going to say no. I'm going to say it's too bad that they didn't spend the way we thought they would in the offseason, because they sort of set us up. They sort of created an expectation of the offseason. We've got money. We're ready to spend it. And they did to an extent. Robbie Ray, awesome signing. You committed financially. That's a big spend. Winker's a less known commodity. He's a guy that has never played 162 in his career. All-star last year, certainly. But, all right, is he that guy day in, day out? You're already talking about platooning him when he's facing lefties out there. And then you take on $35 million of a salary in Suarez, who's an all-or-nothing guy, who's a lot of swing and miss, can hit for power, and is below average as a defender. So, you know, and then you throw in Frazier. Those are your big additions, where we were all spent the whole offseason talking about Bryant and Story and Freeman, all these guys I brought up earlier. So I think if I'm going to lament the fact that they didn't do something or did do something, it's going to be, yeah, I really wanted them to get another bat.
Okay.
I really wanted another bat. And Jerry himself said, hey, we want another arm. We want and not a back of the rotation arm. We want somebody more towards the top of the rotation arm. And for whatever reasons, they couldn't pull that off. They couldn't get that done with a rotation. They couldn't get it done with another bat. Now, is that because they felt like we've got Younga, we've got Kirby there, we've got Brash, we're fine, Emerson Hancock, we've got Julio, we've got Kelnick, we're fine, we don't need to spend that money? Or was it that they just couldn't get the deal done? Mm-hmm. You need the other side to cooperate to some extent. So yeah. I don't really know the reasoning as to why it didn't happen, but I think I'm going to lament the fact that they didn't bring in more proven commodities. That's what I'll have the regrets about, I think, if things go the wrong way.
I guess two things. Number one, you could still conceivably do that over the course of the season.
Right.
Right. The trade deadline is from now until July, and they have been active in that. If this team continues to pitch and play defense, which have been positives out the gate here, then you could still do that. You could still make moves, not in the free agent situation, obviously, but even with the free agents, would you have done the Chris Bryant deal? Would you have done the Trevor Story deal? Would you have paid and made that kind of commitment, and some places blocked people with that kind of commitment financially?
Well, who are you blocking with?
Because you can't have it both ways, Bob.
What?
You can't lament it.
Right? A wise man said that a few times. Yeah.
Yes.
No, you know what? It's not my money, and you don't have a salary cap, and the Mariners aren't even close to the competitive balance tax. So to answer your question, yeah. Yeah, I would have spent that money. Now, it's not my money. I don't know what their budget is. But again, they're not even sniffing the CBT. Mm-hmm. They're on the lower end of payroll. So, you know, would I have spent that money on Story? Yeah. Yeah, I think I would. Chris Bryant, bigger deal than I thought he was going to get. But would I bring that in here? Would I say, okay, is it going to pay off? Yeah, I think I would have. He's getting more than I thought. So I understand that sticker shock initially. But, you know, again, you're not functioning with a salary cap here. And they're not anywhere close to that luxury competitive balance tax. So to answer your question, yes, I would have spent that money.
Well, you know, perfect segue. I promised the listeners before the Ascend read, which is amazing, and their brunch is amazing. You said sniffing.
This is a great segue. Yeah.
You said sniffing. They're not even sniffing the luxury tax. So why don't you share the story as we look to opening day, we look to the bunting and down there, T-Mobile. Yeah. We look to the outdoor show that you love to do to feel the pulse of the people on the streets.
Yeah. I do love doing the show. I just don't love where we do it from, because every year we're set up in this shady area outside of left field, out there by the giant mitt with a hole in it that I call the Russ Davis Memorial.
Oh.
Yeah, that's where we're set up. And oddly enough, there'll be sun shining across the street. So you'll feel okay when you're standing there. But we're in this little shaded wind tunnel, and it's always
very windy. Yeah.
And it's freezing. It is freezing when you sit there. It can be 60 across the street, but you're sitting there shivering in the shade and the wind. And, you know, we're out there every year. It's what we do. We're out there welcoming the fans. It's opening day, the pomp and circumstance. We're all excited, and we're broadcasting live from there. And it's often very, very cold there. So that would lead to Groz calling in sick on those days.
I've got the colitis flaring up. I got to stay home. I can't. I'm not going to be able to make it today.
So I often had a fill in out there with me. And one year was our mutual buddy, Chris Egan. And it was a very cold day. And, you know, we're facing each other, talking, having a conversation on the air. And I noticed that he's got basically like a slug running from his nose down his upper lip, almost into his mouth. And I'm just watching this line of snot go down. And he doesn't know it. He's not aware of it. I think it's too cold. And I'm sitting here thinking, how do I do this with a crowd of people watching us?
I mean,
how do I signal him that, hey, you got something? Because I was used to that with Groz.
Him. You could have reached over and handled it for him.
No, that's never going to happen. It'll run down to his shoe before I would do something like that. But, you know, with Groz, I was used to telling him, hey, you got something going on in there, man. You need to take care of that. But with Chris on the air in front of a crowd of people out there in public, how do I tell him about it? So I just didn't. I just sat there and waited until we hit the commercial break. And then I was like, dude, there's some napkins around here or something if you want to take care of what's going on there.
Some on the lip there.
Yeah, but that's how cold it was. He had snot running down his face. He wasn't aware of it. And there was really no gentle way of telling him without drawing attention to it in front of all the people out there.
Yep. Can't paint a better picture for what's to come with opening it. What is the forecast, by the way? Have you taken a gander?
Like 55, maybe partly sunny, to be optimistic.
So it'll be, what, 40 cloudy? Where we're at with the wind tunnel there and the shade? It'll probably be 40, so we'll bring a bunch of tissue.
The Wyman's tough. Wyman ain't going to call out. Wyman will persevere.
Well, Wyman I've worked with. When you've worked with somebody enough, you can kind of give him a look, like, you know, rub the upper lip, like, hey, you got something happening there. Chris and I didn't have that rhythm yet, so that, you know, he was filling in. So it was a tough set of circumstances.
Seattle Area Brunch just reached new heights. Ascend Prime and Steak Sushi in downtown Bellevue now offering an innovative weekend brunch service every Saturday and Sunday, Bobby, from 10 to 2. Mm-hmm. Guests are invited to brunch on the 31st floor at Lincoln Square South and join the team at Ascend Prime for an experience unlike any other. What do I mean? Well, Ascend Prime's weekend brunch was created with sharing in mind, with the menu curated into three different tiers featuring items like, you ready for this, Kyle? You ready for this, Bob?
Getting hungry.
Have you ever had a steak and egg fried rice dish?
Ooh, that sounds good.
How about a Fruitopia pancakes? How about lardon hash and eggs? Dungeness crab avocado Cristino Benedict. With lunch focus plates, you got the spicy tuna prosciutto pizza. That's Ascend's number one contemporary sushi roll reimagined as a pizza. You've got something I don't know how to pronounce, robata skewer plus congee. And of course, something I can pronounce, a tempura lobster roll sandwich, plus creative and whimsical libations to pair alongside your new favorite brunch dishes. View the full menu and book your table indoors at ascendprime.com.
Brock, 2 weeks, one day from right now, it's going to be me, Dave Wyman, and the great Brock Heward live from the VMAC handling all of the business of the Seahawks draft, of which they've got picks they haven't had since Pete Carroll started year number one with Earl Thomas and Russell Okung, a top 10 pick. What are they going to do? And I've been saying this, and I want to get into the position groups and everything you think are priorities, but I think they've got so many needs that it's kind of, I don't want to say they can't screw it up because they've taken some left turns that had everybody scratching their head. But position-wise, it seems like it could be hard to screw this up other than drafting a tight end with that number nine pick.
Yeah.
I think you win by saying, oh, lineman, okay, they needed that. Oh, pass rusher, yes, you needed it. Cornerback, yep, you needed that. Quarterback, okay, I don't know if he's in this draft, but those all represent pressing needs. So in terms of addressing positions, it's kind of hard to screw this up, isn't it?
100% agree. Offensive tackle, defensive end, cornerback. I think their interior of the offensive line, they feel pretty good about. And the addition they made on a one-year deal, a guy has familiarity in the system, some young people you like, some guards you like, Gabe Jackson you like. So I don't think there's an interior offensive line. You pay Rashad Penny. Now, Chris Carson's neck comes into fold, you know, and the Seahawks will report next week for the beginning of their offseason training. We'll see if Chris is there. We'll see what the latest report is, if he's able to continue to hit his career. If he is a go, then I think you take running back off the shelf as well. Obviously, Tyler or DK at the top of the receiver deal. We'll see with DK what happens before the draft. I don't anticipate them getting enough back now for DK that they pull the trigger, but we'll see.
Between now be? And what would enough be in your mind?
They will need another top 15 first round pick, top 10 first round pick, and then somebody else, and somebody else. Yeah. Right.
Because if they do that, that the idea that, hey, we're not rebuilding, we're competing, that's out the window. You get rid of Russell Wilson, you get rid of Bobby Wagner, and then you get rid of a 24-year-old superstar in the making in DK Metcalf.
Yes.
That represents tearing it down. We're starting over.
It does. But thankfully, in the NFL, as the Bengals showed you, you can start over quickly and mm-hmm. you can go from worst to first in the Super Bowl in a year. So it's not baseball. Tear it down. Wait 5 years. It's not the NBA. Tear it down. Wait 10 years. If, you know, or for perpetuity like the Kings, you know, the NFL is, yes, you can rebuild and you can get healthy in a hurry. But I would, you know, agree with you. Offensive tackle, defensive end, and cornerback are their biggest needs going into this draft. And they've got capital they've not had in the past. Last week, I dug into corner and I went linebacker, though I think Cody Barton's going to get a shot at it. And I went linebacker mostly because of how much, you know, and how highly I think of the kid out of Utah, Devin Lloyd, who I think is just a generational kind of talent at linebacker. And if he were there, if you were to trade down and he were there at 15 or 13 or something like that, I think Sauce Gardner out of Cincinnati is a generational corner, a CB1 that you would take at number 9. So I hit on that last week. I'd like to go to O-line, D-line, because I think we knocked two birds out with one stone of their biggest needs, offensive tackle and pass rusher. And Bob, this is a draft that is not loaded like after pick 15. This is not one that I'm like, oh yeah, trade down from 9, go to 17 or 20, and you can still, nope. Mm-mm. There is a significant drop from the very top end, I think, of both of these positions, offensive tackle and pass rusher, to the next tier down, a pretty significant drop. And at the top, there are some special dudes. The kid out of NC State, I got to see in person. I got to study him. Ike Ekwonwu is the closest thing to Walter Jones coming out of the draft since we've seen a long time. Hmm. He is that kind of athlete. He doesn't have Walt's power. Walt had like athleticism of a 240-pound man, and that's what this guy has. And he has the same kind of football ferocity and everything. He doesn't have, though, what Walter had, and that was get in the weight room, Bob, and literally do nothing for 2 months. Come in March at the start of training. That's what it was back in the day. And it would be like, oh, hey, what did that rookie bench press? He did 315 14 times. Good. Put 315 on and Walt will do it 15 just to show him, like, you know, and that's not an exaggeration. He had that just rarest of power with his athleticism.
How big of a gap is there between Ike and Evan Neal?
There's a gap. I think there's a gap that's not that big of a gap because Evan Neal out of Alabama, who you referenced, is 6'7". He was 350 at the combine. He shed 13 pounds at pro day. He was 337. He's got 34-inch arms. He's the one that does box jumps and splits. And you're just not, you know, you're not supposed to be a human that can do that. So I would put those two athletically, just tradey, just physically, in a place that's just different than everybody else. I do think this is an important part, though, when you're looking at tackle. As I said, I don't think they're going to draft a guard or a center in the first, any of those three picks out of the first 41. I think they're going to draft a tackle. And when you do, I think this is important. I think it's important to look at now your O-line coach, and Andy Dickerson, and what he wants to do and where he came from and what's important to him and where he came out of. We all know is the Rams. And you look at their guys, Rob Havenstein, the right tackle, 6'7", 321, 34-inch arms. Didn't run great coming out of school. Vertical 28.5, pretty good. Andrew Whitworth, 6'7", 334, 35-inch arms. Ran great out of college, 28-inch vert, you know, powerful guy. David Edwards, another guy they drafted. He's actually played guard. I'll be curious if they move him to tackle now with Whitworth's retirement. 6'6", 308, almost 34-inch arms. So you start to look at what that scheme and those guys have wanted out of that position. then, you know, I look at this, you know, kind of cast of characters, and what do all those guys have? They're 6'6", 6'7", with, you know, go-go gadget arms, because this isn't a power scheme. This isn't what Mike Solari still wanted to do. This is a reach and grab. This is a move your feet. This is hook people. This is use your length and your size to really win on the edges. And that's where obviously an Icky or an Evan Neal are special. And, you know, you start to look down the list and Trevor Penning. Okay, I rattled off the size of those three Rams guys.
Mm-hmm.
Trevor Penning, Northern Iowa, 6'7", 330, 34-inch arms, ran 4.89, jumped 28, and also benched 225 29 times. Now, Daniel Jeremiah has him as his number 22 prospect. He's actually kind of fallen a little bit, as has the guy right next to him, Charles Cross, Mississippi State. He's 6'5". 310, 34 and a half inch arms. He also ran 4.95 and jumped 26. So those would be the next two that I think, you know, if you're looking, oh gosh, do I want to pull the trigger? Is that a little much for nine? Are they still going to be on the board if I trade from 9 to 16 or 15? I think those two could be, but you never know with teams in the desire and the need for offensive tackles. But
are those guys, do you look at them and say, they, if they get either one of them, whether it's Neal, whether it's Icky, they're ready to jump in and start day one, because that's what they need right now.
Oh, if you got either of those, that is your generational Russell Okung. You start
left
day
tackle.
One. Yes.
Because right now you don't have a left tackle or a right tackle.
Correct. In a Blue 88 next segment, I'll dig into that kind of conversation a little bit more, because I think Dwayne Brown, and I think some of that is based on what happens in this draft. There is no way that Icky is going to be there at 9. No way. That's not going to happen. He's probably, depending on the teams in front and what they do, or someone comes up, like, he's going to go top 5, period. Maybe number 2. Maybe number 3. Whatever. He will not be there at 9. Evan Neal, will he be there at 9? More than likely not. I mean, just 6'7", 350, and the way that he moves, those guys just don't, they don't stay on the draft board long.
You put them above everybody, hypothetically. They're both available. Sauce Gardner's available. The linebacker out of Utah's available. They're all just there. For whatever reason, they aren't picked. You get to pick number 9, and they're all available. Who are you going with?
Oh, Icky for sure.
It's a no-brainer.
That's a no-brainer.
Okay.
Yep, that guy's going to be an absolute stud in this league. You just, like, watch tape, you know, as I got to do back on the college football trail this year, Bob, which will make working with you and Wyman and being together in person in the building so much fun here in a couple weeks with the draft. You just watch tape and you're like, that's not right. Like, hold on a second. Let me rewind that. Why is he running like a receiver? How does he move at that size? The way that he does, that's just not. And if that jumps out to me, trust me, those scouts and the people in the personnel departments, they're just licking their chops. So there is no way on earth that he will be there at 9. Evan Neal, more than likely not as well, unless you get a ridiculous run on a couple receivers or a quarterback or two, right? If Malik Willis were somehow, someone pulls the trigger and, oh my gosh, now Kenny Pickett's got to go to Carolina. And I mean, that would be the greatest thing in the world for the Seahawks, is if any quarterback or wide receiver went there. I think, unfortunately, that's not going to happen at quarterback. And maybe a receiver does, but both of those big men are off the board.
Well, and it would also represent a commitment we haven't seen this team make to the O-line since Russell Okung. And they bring in Dwayne Brown, which was a big move for them. But everything else they've done is, let's get this guy in, and we think he's loaded with potential, and if he lives up to it, it's going to be great. James Carpenter, Jermaine Ifedi, or some of the free agents they've signed, and Robert Gallery, you can go back that far, or Luke Jokel, or Bradley Sowell, or Jamarcus Webb, or Paul McQuiston. I mean, it's just one miss after another.
Names. They just rattle off your tongue.
Well,
like
because they've been so
like
monumental.
Like a snot bugger off Egan's nose.
I can tell you their salaries.
Yes.
$7 million for Luke Jokel, $3.5 million for Jamarcus Webb, who was the highest paid O-lineman at the time he was on the team.
Gosh.
And yeah, so they've really had a hard time.
Bad wet towel, you said bad wet
oh
towel
yeah
too.
Bradley yeah. Sowell, yeah, it just they've I feel
been
like
too
they've,
cute they've been too cute
they have yep. And then when they've spent money, they spent it wrong. Luke Jokel, $7 million for that
Correct.
Guy yep. So I feel like they've tried to go bargain shopping, like, hey, this guy has the potential to truly do something, and we're not breaking the bank for him, let's go with him. Jamarcus Webb, let's go with, you know, these guys, and it just has not worked out.
Nope. And at nine, you're in a different realm as you were with Russell Okung when you got that one right. Like, you just have a different caliber of freakish athlete. Unfortunately, I think there, and maybe this will help in this discussion and will certainly help as we build into this draft in a couple weeks, Bob. I think it's those two. And then just like Daniel Jeremiah, there's a pretty big gap. Like, those two are right up there. I think Icky is actually his number two guy behind Aiden Hutchinson. Mm-hmm. Evan Neal is up there as well. So after those two, there's a pretty good gap in Daniel's mind. Those two dropped in Penning and Charles Cross to 22 and 23. And then the next couple tackles drop again to 41 and 42. Kind of some guys that have some traits. Tyler Smith out of Tulsa, Bernard Ryman, an Austrian exchange student in high school that's 6'7", 305, 33-inch arms, bench press 30 times. Powerful, powerful dude, but raw. And then Tyler Smith, the kid out of Tulsa, super raw, 6'6", 332, 34-inch arms. But I think last year had 12 holding penalties himself at Tulsa. So a pretty good gap between some of them, but some raw goods that you haven't had here that are so much better than all those names that just rattled off of you. So
pecking order and position group, like, just priority wise, you go O-line far and away your biggest need, followed by what, pass rusher, cornerback, yes, pass rusher. How do you prioritize the position group?
I equalize OT and D-end. I think those are equal weights. I think the difference is you do have Dwayne Brown still out there. In a possibility, right? So you don't, you know, and I think a guy that can still play at a high level. Mm-hmm. Who was the right tackle?
Brandon Shell.
There you go. Shell. He's still on the market, as well.
You got Jake Curran. He was okay.
He's a guy. Yep. He's a guy. You know, scrapper and experience and everything else. He's a guy want on your roster. Yes. He's good depth, but he's not anywhere athletically like even those six guys that I referenced right there. So offensive tackle, defensive end, I put in the same vein. Now, here's the difference. I think the delta between Icky and Evan in the next step down is more significant than the delta at defensive end pass rusher. Obviously, Aiden Hutchins more likely going to go number one, mm-hmm, right? And then you've got a group in Trayvon Walker and Jermaine Johnson and Kayvon Thibodeau. And I'm going to throw just a human force of nature unlike anything we've ever seen on earth. Jordan Davis, who's an interior guy, but I mean, he's just a different human. Because of need, I'm not going to lump them together, but those three, Walker, Johnson, and Thibodeau, those three do not have as much of a gap, if that makes any sense. So the hope that maybe a receiver or a quarterback or somebody goes and a flyer goes, you know, or linebacker, someone loves Devin Lloyd and takes him at number eight, and all of a sudden one of those three guys is available at nine, and I would put probably Walker one, Johnson two, Thibodeau three. Not probably, I do. That would be my pecking order for those three. Those three are pretty, pretty freakishly different than anything that you've seen drafted by the Seahawks at that position in a long, long time.
Thibodeau kind of worries me only because I listen to people like you, people who follow the college game very closely. I can sit there and watch highlights of him, and highlights make everybody look like a Hall of Famer. So he looks great on tape, but I hear a consistent theme with him, which you would know is true or not true better than anybody, that the effort is a little inconsistent, that there's some red flags about the motor or his want to.
Correct.
Or I don't love hearing that.
You've made a couple million bucks in name, image, and likeness already.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and you've seen the switch go on and off already.
I don't love that in a top 10 pick.
I don't either. So he may not even be one that I would take at nine, but he's one that traits-wise, 6'5", 258, running 4.5, and benching 225 27 times at the combine, and can take over games. See also Stanford and some games that he has totally decimated and destroyed games single-handedly. He's got those kind of tools. The other two, Walker and Johnson, are, as I said, pretty freakish. Bruce Irvin they loved, right? Where'd they take Bruce? Like 16?
16, I think.
Yep. Bruce was not 6'5", 275, nor 6'5", 262 with 34 and 35 and a half inch arms. So the kid out of Georgia, Walker, not huge production, 8.5 career sacks, asked to do all sorts of things, would be a home run fit in the Seahawks system with their new scheme and things they want to do at 6'5", 275, 35 and a half inch arms, jumped 36 and ran 4.51. I mean, what does Pete Carroll say all the time about Aaron Donald? Sorry, Mike, when Salk asks him time and time again, why can't you block him? Well, I'm sorry, Mike. Okay. Tell me how many 280 pound human beings there are that run 4.5. And that was Aaron Donald out of college. Trayvon Walker is 6'5". Aaron's 6'1". Trayvon Walker's 275. Aaron's probably 285. Trayvon's got 35 and a half inch arms. And Trayvon ran 4.51 and jumped 35 and a half. That's just not human stuff, right? I mean, it's just not. Human beings are not supposed to look like that and do that and run the way that he did. And you see it show up. Now, he's had to drop back. He's had to play five technique. He's raw. He doesn't have, you know, 100 different moves. But, you know, that never has scared Frank Clark. That never scared Daryl Taylor. That never scared, you know, them from taking guys in the draft. Taking that, though, at number nine, when you would be a ninth pick with 8.5 sacks, that would be the one little kind of red flag. Wouldn't bother me if he's there at nine. You take that kind of freakish athlete.
All right. One last thing before we move on. And I don't even, do we have a clock on a podcast? Or
you, no,
do we just talk until we run out of ammunition? But what's your level of confidence they make a pick at nine? Because we've known their history is to.
It's high.
Yep. You don't think they might trade down?
I think the rest of this league looks at this draft like I do and says there's, you know, at each of these positions, offense tackle, there's two, and there's a drop-off. Defensive end, there's two or three, there's a drop-off. Linebacker, there's one, there's a drop-off. Receiver, there might be three, there's a drop-off. Quarterback, I don't think there's any. Running back, I think Breece Hall and Kenneth Walker are late first-round guys. Safety, there's not a top-end guy, right? So you kind of go through this list, D-tackle maybe. You're not getting beyond 15, you know, 20, certainly not to 20, of just, you know, freakish, of just total difference makers. And so I don't think it's a, oh, yeah, we can trade back, because I think most of these teams that are going to be picking want one of these difference makers as their own. So I think, yeah, and sitting at nine, a position they don't ever, ever want to sit in again, and you have a chance to get a tackle, a pass rusher, or a corner, you should be able to get one of these three positions, one of these studs that I'm talking about, whether it's Sauce Gardner, whether it's Devin Lloyd, whether it's Icky, whether it's Neal, whether it's Walker, whether it's Johnson. You know, and I haven't even got to a couple receivers, too, that'll be next week. You should be able, at nine, to have one of those, slot them in. Day one starter, like you did with Russell Okung and Earl Thomas years ago.
This is Brock and Salk's Blue 88.
Blue 88!
We take you to the field as Brock Heward breaks down three football questions as only he can.
Now here's your hosts, Brock Heward and Mike Saul.
Blue 88. I swear this was called something else before. I'm certain this wasn't always 88, but it's nope. Blue 88, I guess, these days. I don't know. Am I imagining that?
Bob, there's a lot of play calls.
Okay. Yeah.
Playbooks are pretty deep, pretty rich.
You're right.
You can move numbers around.
You're right. Okay.
So red, right, tight, close. Blue. Sprint left, GU corner, halfback, mm-hmm. flat, on two.
That's the one I remember.
Ready, break.
Yeah, that well one. Done. Yeah, that's good stuff. All right. Hey, let me ask you this. Let's talk about the draft. We were spending time talking about specific position groups and things like that, but looking at the Seahawks roster, who's on the roster, and maybe some guys like Dwayne Brown, Brandon Shell, who are, I guess, technically former Seahawks at this particular moment. Who's going to be most impacted by what the Seahawks do in this draft?
Yeah, I think it's that tackle position. That's number one, right? You'd point to, I think, similarly, that their needs. Offensive tackle, defensive end pass rusher, cornerback, right? Probably to some degree in that order. So the fact that Brandon Shell is still on the street, that Dwayne Brown is still on the street, I do think that that is because of this draft and because of the potential of what falls to you at nine, of what you do then in the low 40s, of what transpires there. I think Geno Smith would be another one that you would add to that list, right? Alongside those three positions, you also say, hey, we've heard Pete say time and again, right? The combine, at the owners' meetings, like, we really want Geno back. We really want Geno back. We'd really like to get Geno back. We'd really like him to compete with Drew Locke. Well, I think that's also maybe a tell. If you want him back, I'm sure there's not anybody else that's throwing money at Geno Smith. So if you really wanted him, you could probably get him done right now with a minimum deal and maybe some incentives. But I think you probably equally wait and see. Does a Desmond Ridder or a Matt Corral, are they sitting there at 40, 41? Are those intriguing enough to compete then with Drew Locke because you like them or somebody else? So I think those would be kind of the couple that come to mind right away. And as I said, you know, last segment as well, or last topic of the Chris Carson, you know, there's an X factor there. That is a significant injury when you're talking neck injuries with running backs and spinal cord. We have seen it with Cam. We have seen it with Cliff Averill. We saw that beforehand with Mac Strong. We know that in the position that he plays in the lifespan for NFL running backs, you know, I'm going to be very curious what the report is when they start next week. Is Chris Carson there? What's the latest and greatest? What's the update? Will we not know until he takes a hit in training camp? You know, is that neck sustainable and something that he wants to move forward with? So, yeah, a bunch of unknowns, a bunch of Seahawks that are currently on the streets that I think after the draft in 2 weeks, we will have a ton more clarity.
Yeah, it's nervous talk when you talk about neck injuries. We saw it with Ricardo Lockett, obviously, as well. And, that's scary stuff. All right. Tell me about Drew Locke. Help me feel better about Drew Locke, because I look at the numbers. I'm not going to pretend I watched a bunch of Bronco games. And again, I could look at highlight reels where he looks like he's Joe Montana. But tell me about Drew. I know you've had some interaction with him. Where are you at with him?
A couple things. I think number one, you and Dave and everybody on air on a daily basis, Salk and Jake and Stacy and everybody that covers the team and is around the team, is going to say, wow, what a breath of fresh air. That is a genuine dude. He is just a genuinely good guy. The people in Denver say that. The people that covered the team, the radio hosts that I've gotten to know out here would all say the same thing. They didn't root against Drew. They actually rooted for him because, yeah, while he's, you know, maybe likes to dance a little, likes to have a little fun, likes to do some of those things and didn't have a whole bunch of pelts on the wall, earned before he, you know, did some of that stuff. By and large, off the field, press conferences, meet him, talk to him, just a genuine good dude. And I think with some of the star power that came with Russ and some of the entourage that came with Russ and some of the off the field stuff the last few years and challenges and agent and everything else that came with Russ, there is going to be a breath of fresh air for those that cover the team and go, wow, he's just a good dude. He's just a genuine real article. Doesn't really pose, isn't a faker, doesn't try to present to be something that he's not. From a football perspective, Bob, it will all be to me, and I'm going to get to call the preseason games again this year, and you're going to hear me say this time and again, whether it's a rookie they draft at 40 or 41, or whether it is Geno and him competing for it, it is anticipation and accuracy. Those are the two things that have limited him and his efficiency. Did not play in a great system in college that he could grow and incubate in and learn how to anticipate. It was tempo, it was quick game, it was 100 hitch routes and fade routes and choice routes. And then he's had two different coordinators, a couple different systems here. Actually played well in a similar system in year number one that he's going to have verbiage-wise here. But anticipation and accuracy, that will be the two areas all offseason long that he's going to work on. I know, in OTAs, and he will be there and he will be present. And it's not going to be, oh, I wish we were there practicing. He will be there. He will be present. But can those two areas grow in his game? And if so, I think he's a guy that people and Seahawks fans will want to root for. Is a pretty genuine dude.
Yeah, personality-wise, I can see that. I've seen the interviews. He seems like a very likable guy. But we're bottom-line business here, Brock.
Yep. Yes, you are.
And the idea of a three-way competition.
Can't have it both ways. Can't be a good guy and a businessman.
A three-way competition between Drew Locke, Geno Smith, and Jacob Eason, just as Dave Wyman says, doesn't blow my skirt up. Nope. It does not get me excited about the potential of that position, at least for this season. So
did he say that?
He says it all the time. Says it all the time. Yes. But it just, I mean, come on. I feel like we're talking ourselves into these guys. I mean, you know who Geno is. He's a backup for a reason. And Jacob Eason, we love him because he's local and he's got size and the measurables. But has he
You know what would be interesting, though? And this would be an interesting hypothetical. And they love to do this. And you'll see articles all the time. Oh, if we redrafted the 2012 draft, or if we redraft the 2015 draft.
Right.
If Drew Lock were a prospect coming out of Mizzou like he did 3 years ago, if he were the same exact guy, 6'3", 225, rocket arm, everything else, coming into this draft class, where would he be? And would you be talking about him as a possible first-round pick? They did 3 years ago. The Giants were supposed to go with him and not Daniel Jones at 6. They didn't, and he sat in that green room for the whole rest of the night, just like Geno. That'd be one thing they'd have in common. They were two guys that, unfortunately, on draft day, had to sit in that green room with the camera on them all day long until they went in the second round to the Jets and to the Broncos, respectively. But if he were in this draft, would I like him better than Kenny Pickett? Yes. Would I like him better than Malik Willis? Totally different. Totally different. Like, launching pads and learning curves and everything else. Would I like him more than Desmond Ridder? Probably. Matt Corral? Maybe. But he'd be kind of right in that same vein, which is why if they take one of those guys at 40 or 41, it'll make for one heck of an intriguing competition.
All right, let me ask you about Husky football, because this has not gone the way they wanted with Jimmy Lake and everything. They make the coaching change. So give me the early buzz on the street as far as it pertains to Husky spring football.
Early buzz is, man, what a bummer that this was not the staff that followed Chris Peterson. That's the early buzz. It's not. Reality is true. Departures are true. Recruiting is true. They are thin. They're not, you know, where they need to be to compete with an Oregon or in some ways even a USC at the top end talent pool, Utah, that's super stable in this conference because of some of the recruiting losses, because of some of the transfers. But Kalen DeBoer and his staff and offense and defense, I'll go back to the word I used with Drew Lock, genuine. Genuine. The pendulum has swung. Unfortunately, I would have bet on Jimmy Lake having success. He was, to me, more than qualified. I was wrong on that one. I thought he was ready for that position. He was not. He handled it poorly. He handled people even worse. And the pendulum has swung to just a very genuine, South Dakota-rooted, salt-of-the-earth kind of guy that is going to be a good fit. It's going to take a little bit of time. And to me, the coaching won't be the question, Bob. It will just simply be, in time, the ability to bring the talent. When you're competing NIL with USC, NIL with Oregon, and the stability of some of the other programs in the conference.
All right, before we get out of here, I got to ask you, are you a checkbook guy? Do you walk around with a checkbook and write checks in the grocery store line? Are you that guy?
Interesting. Oh, you're playing that. You're firing that shot, huh?
I thought I had it fired at me earlier.
Yeah. You did. Yes, you did.
I was accused by Mike Lefko of being a checkbook guy, like Dave Wyman, as he puts it. I think that was an age shot, is what that was. I think that's his indirect way of saying you're old.
Ages.
Which we know isn't true in my case.
Not. Wrong. No,
absolutely not. I forget what my analogy was when I did that hit in the morning, but I did. I let it out that I'm a checkbook guy.
You're the guy in the grocery store line holding everybody up.
Never, ever have brought a checkbook to a grocery store or anything like that. No.
Okay.
No, it's just there's some bills that I like to get every month and look at and keep a record of and send a check out. I have, out of my bills, I bet half of them, maybe even two-thirds now, are auto pay.
Yeah.
Right? Like every other normal American, especially a 40-year-old. But there are four or five that I just like to look at that water bill. I like to look at the electricity and gas bill. I like to look. I like it delivered to me. I like to pull my checkbook out like my grandfather used to do. I like to cut that check, put it in the mail, and I feel better about that.
Wow. So you got
What are you checking on that bill? You're saying, you know, my water bill is like same period last year. Okay, did my water use go up or down? Okay.
Yep. I like to look at the little bars. I'm a bar graph guy. I like that. I'm a pie chart guy. I like that. So there are just a few of them that I still am a little bit old.
So you got a roll of stamps there and a stack of envelopes to mail out your bills?
Uh-huh.
Okay. Yep.
Hey, do you have one of those little letter openers, one of those little knives my grandpa used to have?
My grandpa had that too. No, I don't have that. And I don't have the stamp that has my address and name. Yeah. I should, because I still like to write that out. I mean, there's just some about once a month paying a few of those bills that just, you know, brings me back to my roots.
Well, I'll just say this in closing. I have a checkbook that gets used twice a year, and that's for property tax, because I don't really have another option to pay. So, and I'm often confused by it at that point going, oh, wait, I got to write out this envelope. Now, where do I put my address?
Man.
Oh, yeah, I don't have stamps. I'm going to bring it to work.
Memo? What?
I'm going to bring it to work and mail it from work because I don't have stamps. So that's how it works.
Good.
Hey, Brock, this was fun. Thanks for inviting me, buddy. It's always I can't wait. In all honesty, we are going to have a great time out at the VMAC for the Seahawks draft. You, me, Dave Wyman. That is fun every year. Every year that's fun. I can't wait for it.
And when it's been taken away, right? Just like a lot of things taken away, not being able to see people, not feel the juice and the buzz, and there is an energy. And this, as you said, you know, at the start of this, will be different because you've got, you know, some prize real estate. You got Park Place. You're sitting there in the top 10 of this draft with the opportunity to get just a big-time generational difference maker. And let's hope they do that.
Get to the chopper!